The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
The pharmaceutical industry has had a profound impact on our physical and our mental well-being. While we may know the great help that drugs have brought to all of us, we may not realize the potential harm that affects our environment after our bodies process those prescription drugs. On this edition of UWM Today, we focus on waterborne toxins. Joining us in the studio is Rebecca Clapper, the Shaw Associate Professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UWM, and she is now the Director of the Great Lakes Genomics Center at the Freshwater School. Welcome, Rebecca. Great to have you back with us today.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be back.
And you have been on before. This is not a new topic that we've discussed, the notion that there are some bad things getting into the water. But the new twist today is that you, using genomics, can take a look at what impact it's having both on us and on our environment.
Yeah. So we have had an program through my research lab at the School of Freshwater Sciences looking at the processing of pharmaceuticals and personal care products through the sewage treatment plant and out into Lake Michigan, for example, and then looking to see what kind of effects that these chemicals might have after they're discharged from the sewage treatment plant on organisms in the lake. And genomics is one tool in our toolbox that allows us to figure out what kinds of effects these chemicals might have on organisms.
You know, it's probably a surprise to some folks who think that anything bad is getting out into the lake because, after all, we've got these millions of dollars invested in these sewage treatment plants. You would think that that's where the problem would be taken care of.
Yeah. So the sewage treatment plant does a great job at what it was intended to do, which is remove the bacteria and some of the carbon and other things that are coming through sewage before it gets out into our freshwater systems. But you think our sewage treatment plant technology is actually not very old or as fairly old. And so it really wasn't designed to take out some of the things that we now know are also coming through our waste.
Because so, 100 years ago, we weren't using Prozac, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we might have been using some products, but I think people thought that they just degraded in the human body and they would degrade through the sewage treatment system. And it really wasn't a thought that they would get out in any appreciable amount. And so now we know from studies over a decade with the U.S. Geological Survey, our own labs, other labs around the world, that minute amounts of these compounds are getting out into freshwater systems and into ocean systems as they pass, some of them pass through the wastewater treatment plant.
And we're talking about really, really tiny amounts of this, right?
Yeah. So, for instance, Prozac, which you just mentioned, gets out at about 100 nanograms per liter. And if you think of any of the medications that you take, it's usually in a milligram range or higher over the period of a day. And so you think about it, it's way lower than a dose that a human would take to be therapeutic. And so one of the thoughts in the past has also been that at such a low concentration that it really wouldn't have any kind of impact on the environment.
Because with the billions or trillions of gallons of water in a body of water, you would presume that it would somehow be dispersed.
Yeah, especially in something like Lake Michigan, where you think of it as just a huge, it's a freshwater ocean, as we often call it, and that, well, you know, some small amount coming out of the sewage treatment plant really wouldn't even be measurable. But actually, a study that was released by our lab just this past year showed that we are measuring significant quantities of a number of these chemicals coming out of the treatment plant, and then we measure them going out several miles into Lake Michigan. And these are everything from antibiotics to the antipsychosis, antidepressant kind of medications like Prozac, to things like diabetes drugs. Glucophage or metformin isn't one that is commonly taken by people that have type 2 diabetes in our population, and we're finding that at significant amounts out in the environment that we just weren't expecting.
So what impact is it having out there in the lake?
That's the million-dollar question. So a lot of research has been done about these chemicals at doses that you would consider to be therapeutic, and therapeutic dose in a rat or a human or a mouse. But we really have very little information about what happens when you have a very low exposure to these chemicals. Does it still trigger the same pathways, and does it have any kind of effect on the organism that and not only the intended effect, but those side effects that you might read of on the side of the bottle? Does it cause changes in eating? Does it cause changes in other behaviors that we might consider to be important?
So is the worry that you have on what impact it's having on fish life, for example, or is the fear that this might get sucked back into the intake pipe when it comes back for us to reuse again as humans?
And it's kind of twofold. So for some of the chemicals, we're definitely interested in the human health impact. So does it come back in through our drinking water intake? Maybe potentially not in Milwaukee, but in other places, they've measured higher concentrations of these things coming back in through drinking water. For some of the chemicals, though, you know, we use a lot of products in our everyday life, and so the human component through drinking water might not be the big issue. It's the environmental impact where you have, an unintended exposure. So, for instance, you know, when you're washing your hair with shampoo, you're getting exposed to all sorts of chemicals in that shampoo, and it's intentional. You're using it to wash your hair, whereas so that's probably your greatest exposure. It's not through those chemicals then going through the sewage treatment plant and out in the environment and then sucked back up into the drinking water system. But for the fish and other organisms out there, we have no idea what kind of unintended consequences they might have. And it's not an intentional exposure. It's an accidental exposure.
So this is where the genomic center that is recently opened in the School of Freshwater Science comes into play.
Yeah. So genomics is a relatively new tool for environmental studies, where you think of the Human Genome Project. And even here, our great Medical College of Wisconsin, where they're using genomic tools to answer questions about children's medical conditions that have happened since childbirth, for instance. Howard Jacob and that group over there have really pushed the personal medicine envelope by using a person's genetic information to tell something about why a child might have a particular disease. And so if you think of this, it's kind of the human genome equivalent, but for an environmental purpose. So one of the things that we do, you have DNA that's in all the cells of your body, but not all of the genes that are within that DNA get turned on at any one time or turned off at any one time. It really is, for some of them, it's specific to a condition. And so what we can do is kind of take the pulse of an organism, including humans, based on what genes are being turned off or on in that organism. It can tell you about what pathways might be working or not working in an organism, and in that way tell you something about its health. And so we can take some of the principles that have been developed for human medicine using genomic tools and apply it to fish and other critters that are found out in the Great Lakes and in other places.
So do you have a test population of fish that you're working with at the center?
So right now we work with several different types of species. And one of the ones that we use in my lab most often is a fathead minnow, but we also use trout and other organisms. There are some folks that use zebrafish, which is an Asian species. And we use the fathead minnow. It's a local species, actually. It's found in Wisconsin. Anybody that goes musky fishing probably grabbed one of those from a bait shop to throw on their line. And it's a nice organism to use because it, first of all, it's native to the Midwest, native to the United States. And it also has a pretty short lifespan. So within 6 months, we can raise a huge population of these things in the lab. But it also has really cool reproductive behaviors. So people that buy these things in a bait shop just see it probably a soup of these little minnows swimming around in a tank. But if you see them out in a natural population, the male goes and makes a nest underneath like a stick or a rock and then attracts the female underneath. And he cleans the nest and gets it ready for her and then attracts her under there. And then after he gets her to lay eggs, which is kind of a little dance that they do ahead of time, and then he gets her to lay the eggs and he fertilizes them, then he takes care of the eggs. So fathead minnows have a fat pad on top of their head, and they use that to clean the nest and to clean the eggs from any bacteria and fungus. He'll go and he'll pick off any eggs that have gone bad, and he takes care of the young until they hatch, and then they swim away. So it's really this elaborate set of behaviors.
Sounds like the perfect husband.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. The female just swims away. She doesn't have anything to do with them after that. So we can tell if there's something going wrong with this organism, if it's not doing well reproductively, if it's not quote unquote, feeling well if its behavior has been altered. So we look at all of those different behaviors dealing with reproduction, which is really important for the species to keep going, and see if any of them have been disrupted with any of the chemicals that we're studying. And it gives us an indication that, something's wrong and that we might want to study it further with our genomic tools.
And talk about those genomic tools. What sort of equipment are you using? What process do you have in play today that might not have been available a few years ago?
So we have a couple of what we call next-generation sequencers. So prior to this point, the sequencing has been done in very small amounts at a time. And that's what the Human Genome Project was done, is just a couple hundred genes at a time. And now we have these next-gen sequencers that spit out billions of sequences within a couple of days. And so it's amazing. We can tell so much more about what's going on in an organism or what an organism's genome look like than we ever have before. And if you complement that with the amount of genomic information that scientists around the world are gathering on species beyond humans, then what we can do is compare our data to other people's data to figure out a little bit more about the genome of these organisms.
So you've got this terrific piece of equipment, and you've got this test population, these fathead minnows. What are you finding in the first stages of this research that you're doing on these toxins, on these contaminants in the water?
So for behavior-wise, one of the things that we found is that the Prozac, for instance, just to give one example, and this is a paper that was just published last year too, with one of my undergrad students actually here. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has a fantastic undergraduate research program, and Joel Weinberger was one of the undergraduate researchers in my lab and did a study with me looking at the change in behavior with the Prozac exposures that were like environmental concentrations. And what we find is that the males end up changing their feeding patterns. They don't eat as often, and then they also their reproductive behaviors change. So they're not as interested in the females, and they also become aggressive about cleaning their nest and protecting their nest even from females when it gets up to a very high concentration. And so it is altering the behavior of these fish, and particularly in the first couple of weeks of exposure, which we find really interesting. As we know from human studies that it often takes a couple of weeks for the medication to build up in a human and actually have the intended behavioral consequences. And so we're finding a similar thing in the fish. So the fish might actually be an interesting model for what happens in humans biochemically in the brain as they get exposed to this chemical.
So you've used Prozac as one of the tests, I guess. Are there other hormones or drugs that you're looking at?
So one of the things that we're looking at now is the metformin that I mentioned is coming out of the treatment plan. And by and large, people don't exactly know what that does. Even in some of the rat models, we're not really sure which pathways it pushes in order to affect the insulin. There's some very educated guesses. One of the interesting things about metformin is it's also being prescribed for an anti-cancer medication and also as something for polycystic ovarian syndrome. So it has some kind of impact on probably insulin production that also has an impact on reproduction. And so we're very curious as to what impact this might have on the metabolism and the reproduction in fish, let's say. And there are other compounds, too, that I should mention that it might not have necessarily a huge impact on fish, but might have impacts on other organisms. So, for instance, some of the antiseptics that are in our hand soaps, triclosan and triclocarban, have been in the news lately. They're potential endocrine disruptors, but they also have a huge impact on algal populations, which is the base of the food web. And so, for instance, Minnesota has been the first state to put a ban on products that contain those two chemicals, partly because the research that people have done around the world on those chemicals at very low concentrations being found in the environment.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Great to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak, and joining us in the studio is Rebecca Clapper. Rebecca is the Shaw Associate Professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences, the only School of Freshwater Sciences in America, located right here in Milwaukee at UWM. And we're discussing today the work that she's doing as head of the Great Lakes Genomics Center, which is a relatively new lab in the school itself. And Rebecca, for folks who may not have been paying attention the last couple of years, you have a new home, physically, almost ready to be opened up here, this summer, right?
Yeah, within the next couple of weeks, our hope is, anyways, that the scientists from the School of Freshwater Sciences will be by and large transferring from the older part of the building into this brand new facility that's been built right next door to our specifications and has the most modern facilities and will be the home of our new Great Lakes Genomics Center.
It's a $55 million addition made possible with a wonderful investment by the state, located, as you mentioned, adjacent, actually connected to the former home for the Great Lakes Science
Center,
research facility.
Yeah,
it wasn't really the school back then.
Yeah.
It was a research facility, but a phenomenal place right on the harbor off of Greenfield Avenue. As you take a look at the future of the Genomics Center, you've been talking about the work that you've been doing, looking at waterborne toxins and what impact it might be having on aquatic life. How else might this Genomics Center be used to contribute to a better understanding of the world we live in?
Yeah, genomics is a tool for not only looking at, you know, the health of organisms, but looking at other things as well. There are scientists within our center that are using it for instance, identifying what kinds of bacteria are out in our environment and what is the source of those bacteria. Are they from sewage? Are they from birds flying around? Where is the contamination coming from? There are folks that are trying to develop new monitoring tools for invasive species. So using little fragments of DNA that might slough off of an organism or be excreted from an organism, could we use that to detect, for instance, Asian carp or other organisms that are coming into our waterways from somewhere else? It's being used for our new aquaculture program, which actually we have a new aquaculture certificate that will be coming online starting this summer. And people are using genomics to build a better fish for aquaculture. So fish that are able to withstand disease, are able to grow faster and become fatter and serve as a food resource for urban populations and for the world as our dwindling populations of seafood are causing concern out in the natural environment.
Now, you're focusing right now on freshwater species and the work that you're doing here. Have they used genomics in studying aquatic life in the oceans?
Oh, yeah. There's a really interesting project trying to map the diversity of bacteria, microbial populations all around the world and look and see how they differ depending on the season and by the temperature, by the salinity, by all sorts of things. And I think a general listener might be like, well, so what? I don't care about all these thousands of bacteria that live in the ocean, but they have a huge impact, the small life that lives out in the ocean on our cycles of nutrients and the carbon dioxide that we're all concerned about with global warming and other things. So it's these little tiny creatures play a huge role. And so if we understand more about their populations and what's considered normal or how they change over time with climate change and other factors, it's a very important tool for answering some of those questions.
Because the genome is so ubiquitous, I mean, it is one of the driving forces, the blueprint for life itself. How do you narrow down your research? How do you decide what to look at, what genome to study, and what you will put off for another day?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, there one of the things for environmental research is that we're limited by the number of organisms that have really been sequenced. And so without a picture – so the Human Genome Project happened, you know, within the last decade or so and was completed basically within the last decade or so. And with that information, we've been able to look at, you know, small changes in the DNA and how that ends up impacting the organism. We have comparatively little information about organisms that we find in our environment. There are some model species and those are growing all the time where we have some more genomic information. But by and large, we just don't have the framework that we do for the Human Genome Project. And so one of the things that limits our science is that fact that we try to choose organisms that might have some genomic information so we're not starting from square one. But one of the other things that the Genomics Center is trying to do, the Great Lakes Genomics Center, is basically build our library of what environmental organisms we have genomic information for and try to increase our capability of using this tool as an environmental tool.
Will you be doing any mapping yourself, or are you going to be using work done by others to then measure the impact in this case, of chemicals or toxins on that species.
One of the things that my lab has been doing is looking at lake sturgeon, which is one of the species that's near and dear to many people's hearts here in Wisconsin. And we've, with some funding from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, we've been looking at some of the reproductive genes that are associated with those fish and what kinds of things might cause alterations in gene expression with those reproductive genes. And we, you know, the genome of that organism, it's basically a dinosaur fish. And it's a relatively large genome. And so trying to do a sequence of that whole organism would cost some money that we don't have right now. But we're trying to piece together as much as we can because it's a species that a lot of people care about, and both from a Wisconsin native standpoint, but then also from our evolutionary perspective, what does this ancient fish do that maybe modern fish do or don't do? And how can we relate those using genomic information?
So if I'm a listener and I'm concerned based on what you shared about the health of the aquatic life in the lake and the impact that contaminants like these prescription drugs or hormone treatments might be having on that fish population, but I'm saying, okay, but how does that affect me? You know, is that something I need to worry about in terms of what I put in my own system in terms of food or water that I'm taking in? Is there anybody who's doing the similar type of work on the impact of these toxins on we humans, based on some of the early work that you're doing with these fish populations?
Yeah, and you know, often a lot of the information that we have that relates to human biology is from rats and mice that we use as our model species to model what might happen in humans. And so we have some population information or epidemiology information showing that, for instance, the levels of sperm in human males has declined over the last several decades, that the age that girls reach puberty has also gotten shorter. So it used to be 12, now it's more like 10, 9. And so we know something's happening in the human population, and what the cause of that is, we're just not really sure. So we go back to our animal models to try to figure out what's going on. And fish might provide some of that information. They're a little bit easier to deal with than some of the other model systems.
So it really becomes sort of the canary in the coal mine. You begin to get a sense of if it's happening in this species, could it have an impact on humans?
Yeah, exactly. And trying to relate that back based on some of the physiology information that we have that's similar between these species.
How might that connect to healthcare, to the way that we heal ourselves or prevent disease?
So, with the endocrine disruption example that we were just talking about, and I mentioned previously that Minnesota has put a ban on these couple of chemicals that we have some concern about them being potential endocrine disrupting compounds. Bisphenol A is another one. You heard in the news a couple of years ago that there was enough evidence built up that endocrine disruption was probably happening due to some of the plasticizers found in our plastic bottles, including bisphenol
baby
A.
Baby bottles. I mean, there was a big story. I think a few years ago, the journal Sentinel did a wonderful investigation looking at whether or not that plastic that makes our life so much easier and so convenient in some ways might actually be poisoning infants.
Exactly. And so there's a prime example of where the science has pointed the way of the fact that we might want to limit the use of some of these chemicals.
Rebecca, where do you see your genomic center going 5 years from now? What would you like to be doing then that you're not able to do today?
Well, so our genomic center, I should say, started with this grant from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District and then an investment by the Fund for Lake Michigan and then also the Kikkoman Foundation. And so we've got this foundation of equipment to start out with. And now what we need to do is build in projects that relate to some of our environmental concerns and build some of the sequence information for some of these organisms that we really care about. So I would see going into the future that we'd have more and more information about environmental organisms that we really care about so that we can really maximize the use of this tool.
What kind of people will be working alongside you? Do you have the kind of scientific support, the team that you need to move to that next level?
So the Genomic Center has a small staff right now associated with it, but we also have a whole cadre of scientists that are at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the School of Freshwater Sciences, School of Public Health, Biology, Anthropology, Chemistry. We're also collaborating with people at other UW campuses like UW-Waukesha, and we're trying to build in collaborations with folks at places like the U.S. Geological Survey and the Environmental Protection Agency and Fish and Wildlife and DNR, so that this again, this tool can be really be maximized in its use for a variety of different purposes.
And it sounds like one of the real beauties in terms of your center is that it literally is at the doorway to the, as you put it, the inland ocean, the Great Lakes, which, you know, these days are becoming more and more attractive as water shortages occur all over the country, indeed in many parts of the world.
Right. And so we have kind of a unique focus in that we are focused not only on environmental genomics, but also on the freshwater resources that are at our doorstep. And we really want to help to advance genomics in general, but also the use of genomics as a tool for investigating those freshwater resources like the Great Lakes.
When companies that are making products like the chemical banned up in Minnesota, when they hear about the potential harm, have you had any interaction with those people or those organizations? Are they sensitive to the need to measure or monitor the impact that that these drugs are having or chemicals are having on the populations?
Yeah, there's always a huge policy impact to what we're talking about, and particularly the area of research that I'm in. And so a lot of the places where that policy is discussed, there are also industry experts at the table that are also providing their input into decisions about these things. I haven't spoken to anyone in particular about the companies that make the triclosan and triclocarban, but I know in general there's a willingness at some time to shift to using other products. And there's a whole movement called green chemistry where people are trying to actually decipher these problems ahead of time so that those products don't even make it to marketplace, that you can potentially switch to something that has a more useful or a less harmful alternative.
And that's a really good point, because the fact is that you have so many different options out there. If you can get the same job done without harming the environment, without harming an individual or a species, why not, right?
Yeah, right. And I should say that one of the areas of my research is also investigating nanomaterials, which are a type of chemical that's relatively new to the marketplace but now is in everything. And I'm involved with the Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which is and that's one of the main purposes of it, is to try to develop those design principles for nanoparticles so that when the product goes to market, it has the least potential for harm possible.
You know, I don't know why. The other day I was actually thinking about nanoparticles. I know, because I was putting on sunscreen, and sunscreen, a lot of sunscreen uses nanoparticles because it helps with the application. It makes it more uniform and the like. A couple of years ago, there was a lot of fear. You heard a lot of stories anyway about the impact that these tiny, itty-bitty little chemical structures would have on the environment. Haven't heard much about that. I presume it's just not in the news, but it still is an issue.
It's still a concern anyway. And one of the things that we're trying to figure out is which ones of those nanoparticle types do we need to be most concerned about. You know, there's now a growing body of literature saying that some of these things probably, at least for what we've measured, don't really cause a huge amount of harm, but there's probably other ones that we need to be more concerned about and modify in some way, change the coating around them, change their properties in some way, their surface chemistry, in order to alter their potential effects on the environment. And we're using genomic tools for those as well. We're trying to figure out, if you change the surface chemistry slightly on a nanoparticle, then does it end up influencing the toxicity and the gene expression that might happen after the organism is exposed?
It sounds overwhelming in a sense, because it seems every time you turn around, you have another question that needs to be answered in your field.
Right. And so, again, one of the things we try to do is make predictions. So can you take several of these compounds together and model what you might expect to happen, so that we have some tool in order to say ahead of time that there might be an effect or not. And with the nanomaterial research, we're collaborating with scientists at University of Wisconsin-Madison, Northwestern, University of Illinois, and University of Minnesota to try to answer that problem. We have chemists, computational chemists that are doing modeling. We have biologists like myself. And so we're all trying to come together to solve that problem.
And what a happy scene, a happy picture to have the enormous collaboration that you have.
Yeah, and it's really a really interesting collaboration because it's so interdisciplinary. And so we're able to each bring a different perspective to answer this question. So if you go from, you know, genomics all the way through to computational chemistry and try to develop a model using each part of that puzzle, hopefully you come up with a better model, a better way of making these predictions.
Rebecca, thank you so much. Absolutely amazing work that you're doing at the Genomic Center and along with the rest of your colleagues in the School of Freshwater Sciences.
Thank you, and thank you for your interest.
Rebecca Clapper, the Shaw Associate Professor at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UWM, Director of the Great Lakes Genomic Center, also located at the School of Freshwater Science. Well, that's it for this week's program. Thanks for taking a few minutes to learn about the amazing array of research that takes place each day at UWM. Take care, everybody. See you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.